Welcome back. I think we're at episode 337. Joe, how are you doing?
Just fine. I think I'm being called as a character witness to support Fannie Willis. And I keep waiting for to get the email. I mean, there are rumors about this. We'll see how that goes.
But these are the bitter wages of DEI and affirmative action.
What a mess.
Yeah.
It's almost, pathetic. They're lying about the affair beginning after the employment began, and then forgetting that the phone records showed that this guy had been at her house like over 30 times, from midnight till 5 a.m. And it's just pathetic. And it's now I would presume that you're going to get tacked on charges to against Willis. She'll either have to resign or face contempt of court kind of situation. So it's really but what's really important about it, one, it shows that the character of the people who are attacking Trump, but moreover, it shows what an incredible cesspool the DEI affirmative action government systems are. I mean, this can be used as an example of how, they just basically spend money on anything that they want in a person of a personal nature. They don't really have some kind of overarching altruistic desire to help their people. They're just there benefiting themselves.
Yeah, which is why it shows in cities of, like Detroit and Jackson, Mississippi, and Baltimore, Maryland, and it's
San
just
Francisco.
it just reverts to the African mean if left unguided. Again, yeah, I think she admitted to like maybe half a dozen felonies in her.
Yeah, I mean
She couldn't
it's
identify the term hostile witness, or she couldn't define it. And it's like anyone who's watched episodes of Law and Order should be able to know what that means.
well, the thing is that's the overwhelming kind of reaction to all this is how stupid they are.
Yes.
That she thinks that she could actually bring a case against Trump and hire this guy who is her lover. And then use his funds to go on vacations with. And incidentally, the guy was just given an astronomic salary, just obvious.
Like $300,000 or something,
Yeah,
or like.
it's like three times more than anybody else. So they were just pumping money into this guy, and then they were taking these vacations together. Did they really think this wasn't going to come out? They thought they could hide this? I mean, this is just stupidity. It's almost sad to see this. And I just don't know where it'll all go. I have a feeling that there are more revelations. I have a feeling that this next week you're going to see that, depending on what Willis does, she may resign Monday morning. If she's sensible, that's
Well,
what
I
she'll
don't
do.
think she has the shame or the. Yeah, I don't think
She doesn't have,
she.
yeah, she doesn't. She doesn't have, but she may have people around who just say, look, this is beyond repair. You're going to just get deeper and deeper if you keep going with this. Just resign.
I like how
And
she said that you have to keep a lot of cash on you. All women should when they go out with men. I was like, what? Because the guy she dates skip out on the check? What's
I mean,
It's like
so is the state. So is
the old days it was what, a dime for a phone call or something.
the state. Yeah. I mean, this is the tangled web. When you need a pack of lies to support, your version of reality, it's going to get complicated. And someone like Fanny can't keep all the plates in the air. And now everything is crashed down. And it's just a, you know, it's the world we live in. I mean, I think you could probably go into almost any sort of DEI, governmental structure in any of our cities, and if you just scratch the surface, you'd find the Fannie Willis world is everywhere,
Yeah, a lot of the same with Letitia, was it Letitia James in New York?
Yeah.
Just dumb. And apparently, she's worth like tens of millions of dollars. How does she acquire that much wealth? And then she's accusing Donald Trump
Well,
of malfeasance and without any providing any evidence. But
it's solid.
again, she's got that stupid judge up there too, like levying $350 million fines. Think without any regard to the law. It's just complete. This complete lawlessness.
Yeah.
So.
Well, they just feel like they are there to defeat to its
She's
supersession
also
of
going after like V Dare, which Letitia James up there. this website, which I guess it's chartered in New York. That's her jurisdiction. I don't know, but I thought their headquarters was in West Virginia. But she's like, this is lawfare, and lawfare is bad enough when private attorneys do it to the civil court system, lawsuits. You know, people like Roberta Kaplan, and they're backed by Jewish oligarchs to wage lawfare against organizations that they don't like, and that's how it's done. But when you have a DA's doing it, it's a complete abuse of power, and it really is, they should be brought up on charges because it's a completely baseless case going after a small website which just published an
Yeah,
article.
we'll need to see how this all shakes out. This is really good news because it's clarifying for, kind of heritage American about what is the nature of the opposition.
But she said she claims she isn't racist, and they have a speech of Letitia James, I think, saying that Donald Trump is too male, too pale, and stale.
But that's
It's
the thing.
like,
Is that this is a kind of race war by
yes.
proxy, and they are they feel they're soldiers in it. I mean, Fannie Willis would say that she did nothing morally wrong, and that the money that she's taking in is good for her community, it's good for an oppressed people, and her attack on Trump is wholly justified in a broad historical sense.
Well, the important thing is the money she embezzles, she spends locally.
Yeah, that's right. That's why she keeps the cash on her. She doesn't believe in
It's
credit,
fungible, which is a big word for her, I think. She used the word
Yeah, and
fungible.
that was really, again, that's just the pack of lies creating an impossible,
By the way,
bank.
she got through law school.
I hate to say it, but I would bet if someone did research there, they would find scandal.
Of
I
course, yes.
mean,
It's same with the Harvard Law president.
do you really think that Fannie Willis could pass the bar? For example, I mean, I'm not seeing it. I don't. I mean, she certainly doesn't seem to have any kind of clever sense about sort of the legal structure of
Well,
things.
expecting someone to pass the bar exam of fairly is an attribute of white supremacy. So.
Yeah, it is actually that's and in fact, I was reading this one theorist, a black sociologist, who was saying that we just have to de decriminalize everything.
Yeah, I
Even
saw that. That was that they were playing pool.
Yeah.
There was I think there was, what's that, Crump, that civil rights lawyer, ambulance chaser,
Yeah.
and then you have Al Sharpton, some other clown. There was one guy who was skeptical. I saw. He said, "What, you're saying we're all blacks act criminally?" Then he didn't say much. But the video that I saw, but they were saying is the way to get rid of crime is you just get rid of the laws.
There it is. I mean, it fixed it,
And then
So
we have it like in Detroit, right?
Well, sure, and of course, that would be the logical conclusion of all of this. But then, you get rid of the laws, and you may have fixed the problem of that they perceive of kind of legal discrimination against blacks. But you have replaced that with, well, I mean, the whole world becomes an autonomous zone of just violence, and chaos. You can't have and starvation because without laws and regulations, you can't even
Sounds like
feed them.
sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, no, sub-Saharan African was far more organized and humane than what will emerge out of the welfare system. From what I would have seen of sub-Saharan African in its native state, I mean, it was very primitive. I mean, in general, but it engaged in war. But inside its culture was like far more intact. There was like families and traditions, historical traditions about like women and things like this. You compare that to like the inner
Well,
city.
you apply that to a side of industrial society, but they never had monogamy and intact nuclear families and high child investment. So that's why you have poverty. One of the reasons why you have poverty, other reasons we just have lower. One thing is that you observe the world is for one reason or another, parts of the world never developed and other parts of the world did. And then what responsibility? Then you have to ask the question: what responsibility do the developed parts of the world have to those countries? Christianity had a dispensation for that or instruction for that. Or and what how should we relate to them? The Masonic system, the Judeo-Masonic system, was exploitation and slavery. Christianity, broadly speaking, was conversion and uplift. Unfortunately, the Judeo-Masonic model won out, and then all the whites get blamed for it.
That's true. However, I will say that since I'm familiar with the Catholic Church's treatment of the indigenous Californian populations, that wasn't too good.
Well, that was the Spanish crown, but
Yes.
even but given the wide expense of the Spanish Empire, it was the church and the in defense of the Spanish crown, they did issue edicts and rules of how people should be treated. They're just
Oh, that's
violent.
right. No, there, in fact,
So the sentiment was there, the intent was there. You know,
it
they
just
talk about the encomendian system and all
didn't
that,
work
which.
out in
Yeah,
practice,
the Jesuits, and to their credit, when they were good in the 16th and 17th century, took that on. They were suppressed for it. So there were powers within those crowns that sought to. Basically, there's Freemasonic infiltration into the Catholic, even the Catholic Church, but even the Catholic monarchies at the time. Portuguese and Spanish monarchies were Catholic, but there were Freemasonic influences in
I mean, there's no way to do colonialization, with high-level humanistic principles. You're
yeah.
going to be basically exploitive. But you're right, the Judeo-Masonic version of colonialization was, well, it's genocide. It's just
I
an
mean
absolute.
the in Paraguay, the Jesuit reductions there, they actually had the natives there. They taught them a written language. Probably the language still lives today because of the Jesuits, and the culture exists because of the Jesuit efforts. But they had them there growing their own crops and also making fine goods like violins and for export. But
Yeah, I know.
that was shut down.
I just want to digress just to point something out, that one characteristic that I think delineates evil dictators from benevolent ones is the desire to teach your population to read.
Yes.
If you do that, you really are kind of on the right side of I would say in general humanity. But if you don't, if you suppress it, then well, that just exposes you as evil.
Well, there's a sense, again, like the UN talks
Catholic
about.
Church got more people to read
Yes,
than any other
literacy.
organization in history. In fact, they, including myself, for example. So, I mean, they are to be held in good regard in
Yeah,
that
and
sense.
part of the Protestant, at least the Black legend, is the idea that the church tried to suppress reading, and it was the Protestant Bible. Actually, that's a complete distortion of history. Universities were all Catholic at start, and all that stuff, and so it's an imperfect history. Even efforts are get punished, like the efforts to convert bring Indian tribes and in, you know the disparate, deprived Indian children in Canada into these mission schools. It's
Yeah.
now it's being called cultural genocide, and false accusations are being made. People just accept it, but these are efforts to relieve these people's suffering. Are often abandoned. They get and again, no good deed goes unpunished in this world, and that's a good
Oh,
example of
just
that.
remember, just to I mean, to clarify, we're talking about post-Reformation Catholicism. I mean, the Dark Ages, the feudal system, the church did not promote reading and literacy during that period. But
But
once,
but there are practical limitations to that, given that they spent the cost of printing.
well, there that's no that is absolutely right. However, if you compare like Rome in the first century with Middle Europe during the Dark Ages, you can see that something bad did happen.
Oh,
That
yeah, there was a collapse.
there was a collapse, but also it was just the oligarchs did not really see, the written language and reading skills as useful for their political vision. I mean, the Dark Ages were, they benefited, a few people, and others, the vast majority of Europeans got diminished. In fact, I would argue and have that Europe is still recovering from that period. The whatever all the causes of all of the debasement were, it ended up with Europe having, very low literacy levels, which, then got better. But of course, we were then attacked with the world wars, which, another problem. So anyway, Europe is just Europeans have had, dilution temp.
Yeah, you broke up the first sec. Sorry. Did you see that thing at Google's Gemini AI? You there? Here, you're back?
Yes, I'm back. I don't know what happened. We got
Okay,
cut off.
last. Yeah, did you see the Google's their Gemini AI chat box
Oh
that they
my God,
did?
it's just hilarious.
They said it was on Thursday that it paused the Gemini chatbot image generation tool after it was widely panned for creating diverse images that were not historically or factually accurate, such as Black Vikings, female popes, Native Americans among the founding fathers.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's really important because it shows that the algorithms are not some kind of abstract, objective,
Yes.
powerful computer understanding of all, the intellectual world. These things are programmed for a particular sociologic purpose. And
Yes.
here, they're trying to basically evaporate the history and self-esteem of white people.
Yeah, it is a form of iconoclasm, wiping history clean. This is the problem of relying on the cloud for all data
Yeah.
storage and information. Well, at least in the old days, burning books is a labor intensive, it's very laborious. Whereas if it's just virtual book burning,
Right.
just you just do it with a click of a mouse, it's like they put Winston Smith out of work, right? His job was burning old I think old headlines or news stories so they can
Yeah.
rewrite
He would be
history.
out of work now. They
So
can just code, they can program all this into the algorithm that manifests the information that is given to the people. And
yeah,
boy, that was really a great, I was glad that that came out. It should make people aware that.
someone had fun with it though. Someone put asked to provide a depiction of a 17th century British king eating watermelon, and it came up with a black guy, in a crown eating watermelon.
Well, you can go to some very strange places, once you know the kind of evil like algorithm these things are operating with.
Well, and you say, ask for a picture of the Four Seasons, and it comes up, it looks like it's the Four Tops or in colonial garb. You're like, what's going on here? Obviously, I don't think it was just in their tent to do this. This is the algorithm doing something they didn't really intend. But again, it shows how the algorithm is manipulated to marginalize white people. And if you left AI to be a real AI where it's just pattern recognition, it becomes right wing, which is why they had to twist the algorithm.
Right.
Because it looks at things like patterns of behavior, crime statistics, and things like that, and comes out with the obvious conclusion. And again, it isn't really intelligence. This is an algorithm, so it depends what the data you give it and the orders you and the commands you put into it. So you can't rely on it. And again, if you leave it up for pattern recognition, which you think AI would do, it comes out with the wrong conclusions. So they have to change the conclusions.
Yeah, they
But
should change the name. It shouldn't be AI, it should be PI. It's propaganda information.
yeah, and it's Google. Google has been destroyed as a search engine. People know that now because of the politics of the people in control of it and the ethnicity. It's how do these race commissars? They look ridiculous, but no one's resigning. And the problem here is we can laugh at this, and they get caught looking ridiculous, but they're not embarrassed enough to resign. But the problem is that most, if you look at schools today, most students now are learning with Chromebooks using Google. So they're seeing reality and learning history through the lens of Google and whoever runs Google.
And that was the intent of the internet when it was created. I mean, this is being manifested. They can control how history is presented to the population for the purpose of social control, and that they're doing it. And there it is in real time. You can just see it. So you have to, as a parent, you need to be aware of that. And of course, the public school system is off limits for parents and children who are righteous. You just have to find a way to homeschool and to create the education that is virtuous and real for your kids.
Yeah, it shows you just how again, the public school system is being used as a huge subsidy for these big tech companies like Microsoft or Google to basically to force gadgets upon these students. They don't need computers to learn, but it's easier, or certainly it's easier to indoctrinate them because again, it's much easier to virtually book burn than it is to actually do it,
Yeah, and
So.
it's also easier. It's easier to computer control the minds of young people than to try to do it through, books and things. You can just put in. You can. In fact, the example was the one we're talking about now. Is that the algorithm to promote Black people visually is part of that process. And then it just mistakenly pops up, you know, when you try to look at the history of,
yeah,
of people who are of European descendants. But the intent of the algorithm is very clear. It's to, you know, supersede and evaporate, you know, European history, so that what you learn will be, you know, a debased understanding of your past. You know?
Yeah, it's like if you ask for an image of Ireland in the 18th or 17th century, and it looks like a modern day commercial. There's a Black guy and a white girl. You know, something's up when that image pops up.
I mean,
the BBC has been promoting this.
Yeah. So
the idea that Blacks were prominent in 17th century England or Elizabethan England. The other day I was watching, I was at the gym just looking at the TV screen, and there was some sporting event on. Then they ran commercials, and there were six or seven straight commercials, all Black people in them.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a part of that.
Yeah.
The play Hamilton wasn't a one-off thing, by the way.
It's to try to create this pseudo history of, you know, Africans as part of the replacement of European history. But moreover, it's part of the way to merge the races. The intent here, obviously, is to have one kind of epsilon and delta clump of humanity that's inbred, that there's no ethnic pride or strength, and that'll be easily controlled, you know, mm-hmm. and of course then reduced in population.
Yeah, which is
clear as a bell. I mean, how can anyone, you know, look at the world and not think that?
But again, this is, I think, a function of the New World Order.
The New World Order, indeed. Yeah.
What do we mean by that? What is it? What, you know, have their plans changed? Have they improvised? What is the New World Order? When you mention the New World Order, people tend to look at you like you're a conspiracy theorist. You're kind of crazy. Although it's uttered all the time, it's books are by that title. Politicians mention it. It's understandable because the idea that the world, as you know, our complex world, is being governed or controlled by a hidden cartel, a cabal, seems fantastic until you look into it and you realize, oh yes, this is exactly just how a world would be governed. You'd have to function. You'd almost have to have a cartel, a hidden cartel, engaging conspiracy. Of course, the term. H.G. Wells popularized the phrase in his book written in 1940. Of course, this is written during the Second World War, and he suggests that in order to avoid a conflict, which the world was then experiencing, of course, by 1940, it wasn't quite as destructive. It became much more destructive in the ensuing years. But in 1940, it was a relatively trifling affair. there was a lot to come in the next few years. But he suggested that you needed a world government to govern the world. Of course, then you have the problem is governments, even to this day, were failed in an attempt to maintain peace and public order. And why do you think a world government would be any better? But I mentioned politicians have mentioned it. Mikhail Gorbachev invoked it. George H.W. Bush invoked it. It's been discussed by Henry Kissinger. The New World Order cannot happen without U.S. participation, as we are the single most significant component. Yet there will be a New World Order, and it will force the United States to change its perception. So it's been predicted and called for. Again, it on the face of it appears to be expressing ideals advocated, you know, by the United Nations, which was created after World War II, basically to create a single system of international governance, which compels all the nations on Earth to treat everyone nicely. If only it were that simple. So if that's good, then why are people worried about the New World Order? Well, it comes to an issue of agency and scale, meaning that or sovereignty. How will their New World Order world government represent the interest of the people? Do all people have the same interest in various cultures and all these things? Can agency? It's like how does one have agency in his own life if he's governed by this global government which has no accountability? What's the organizational model for such a thing? We do have a problem of oligarchy. Particularly, we were told that the capitalist order would share the wealth, create broad prosperity, and at least superficially appear to do that in the 20th century, particularly in the West. Now we have a vast concentration of wealth and impoverishment of the other half, so to speak, call it the other half. But I think as of now, the top 1% is greater than the total wealth of the rest of humanity put together, 99%. This vast concentration of wealth creates a vast concentration of power, because under the Judeo-Masonic order, we worship mammon and money rules the world. So whoever has the controls the money has the predominant power politically, culturally, economically. So there's a governance issue here. So the New World Order, it also presumes that we have to, that those in charge, those best and brightest, can model, design such a system, and we should just submit to it. But what is the New World Order? What was it? I mean, the British Empire? Is it the American Empire?
Well,
What is it?
this is a critical question. I mean, what exactly is it? I mean, I wrote an article called Shakespeare's Apocalyptic Brave New World, and I did an analysis of the play The Tempest. It's available online. You don't have to buy it. You can just anyone who's interested can read it. And I showed that the expression New World and then New World Order is related to Brave New World. It actually comes. It's another use of the term. The Brave New World, is an expression from the play The Tempest, and it describes a world that is post-Christianity and is in fact genocidal to Europeans. And you read my analysis of the play, you can see that The Tempest is a cryptic, kind of language of the oligarchs to document what they're about to do to us. The term was then picked up by, well, of course, Huxley, everyone knows, but also by Kipling, and who was was friends with H.G. Wells, and Kipling was like is so often the case, is directly connected to the Rothschild family. His poems were read as eulogies at their funerals, and Kipling himself would vacation with Barron every summer with Cecil Rhodes, and the three of them, Rhodes, Kipling, and Rothschild, were actually in a building getting messages during the Boer War, and they would then discuss the strategy as how to respond to things. So Kipling is another example, like Soros or J. Paul Getty, of someone who is really, a manifestation of the Rothschild family. And Kipling wrote in his poem, The Gods of the Copybook Heading, that after that, excuse me, and that after this is accomplished and the brave new world begins, when all men are paid for existing and no man must pay for his sins, as surely as water will wet us, as surely as fire will burn, the gods of the copybook heading with terror and slaughter return. The gods of the copybook heading, that's an expression meaning the Old Testament slogans that were put on the title pages of the copybooks that British school kids would have, right? So the gods of the copybook heading is referring to the Old Testament, basically. And the expression, when all men are paid for existing and no man must pay for his sins, well, that's the brave new world. That's the workers' paradise. And then, of course, it leads directly, once you've given up all of your agency and you lose all political control, then terror and slaughter return. So this was Kipling's, clear-cut expression of what the what this all means and where this all heads. And then I would, just say that the workers' concept of the workers' paradise is, what is sort of critical here to understand is that they're giving us this idea of, well, like with liberalism, the workers' paradise, Fannie Willis, Atlanta. Once we just get enough racism dealt with and government largesse heading toward the right people, it'll all just work out. Everything will be restored. But you give up your agency, you give up your power, and ultimately this will lead to terror and slaughter. The New World Order expression, that H.G. Wells used, it's the order aspect of it is simply the Masonic order. I mean, that's that word, that term is widely used in the Masonic literature, and it just refers to a world that is ordered by Masonic hierarchy.
Yeah, that's
And
the Council of the Elect and the
exactly.
Apostles and yeah, Rhodes
And of
Circle, yeah.
course, Huxley talked about the world controllers, but it's all the same thing, Tim. It's there's not they have different words and terms, but it's all heading for it's all a process. It goes in the same direction. If you read my analysis of the Tempest, you'll see that the project was in place then, back at the beginning of the 17th century. They already had a lot of these ideas in mind. And one thing I would like to clarify is that people, like with the expression "Brave New World," don't understand it because they don't recognize or have been taught what the term "brave" meant in the Shakespearean era. Brave in this era means something like distracting, or like say, think of a brave fashion line, right? That's gaudy, glittery, and catches your attention. Brave New World is just the distracted New World. And what is the new world? Well, this is the post-Christianity world, right? So this is the new world order. It's the post-Christianity world. The order part of it is the Masonic desire to reestablish the Temple of Jerusalem and the Messiah, to have a Jewish king that would be a world ruler. Which is described in the literature of the Dead Sea Scrolls, this world ruler who will, after the apocalyptic battle, control everything. And so I think that if someone puts the time in, to look through the literature and to see the connections, of all of these things, where it all goes, it's not particularly hard to understand. And when you had written like the description of what we might be talking about today or to me earlier, you would talk about, well, who are these people? Well, I mean, we can see like the Rothschild family, but I would doubt very much if that's actually the controlling aspect of it. I think they would just have someone in front of them that they would use to, for banking power and things. I mean, obviously the Rothschilds are an intersective, point, and there's all these powerful strands that come from them. But there's someone in back of them, and I'm sure I would say basically you just have Freemasonry. You have the unfortunately it's a secret society, right? And as you work your way through it, you'll get closer and closer to the sources of power, but you also get it becomes harder and harder to detect the individuals. You just know that it does exist, right? That's about the best we can do. You can see some of the players that are spun from it. Like the Rothschild family, but and certainly you can see the power manifesting from them downward. I mean, Eustace Mullins did a great job in The Secret of the Federal Reserve, where he showed all the connections that the Rothschild has to the various banking entities and all the corporations and things. It really showed the spider web, of power. And so, people need to be aware that that is our economic and financial and political world. It is controlled in that way. And it is just as the Rothschild compatriot Kipling wrote, it's as surely as water will wet us, the Old Testament gods with terror and slaughter are going to come back.
Yeah, the obviously the New World Order, the British Empire, and you have the Cecil Rhodes and his Last Will and Testament. He came up with this idea of the Rhodes Trust, Milner's Kindergarten, and sort of this network of elites who would organize us. There was an effort that they developed the Pilgrim Society to merge the United States back with the British Empire. They realized they needed, in order for the British Empire to maintain its primacy, they needed the alliance or support of the United States. Which, of course, which was a colony, which ostensibly broke away from the British Empire in the 18th century and established its independence. But there are always financial ties to the City of London. These financial ties are transnational. Often they're along not just business, but also familial and tribal lines. So this is something that a New World Order would be designed upon. And you mentioned the Rothschilds. I think it was Nathan Rothschild who. Was he the patriarch, the leader, the first one? Was that a male? I forget which one. But anyway, he sent his five sons to the principal financial centers of Europe. I think it was Frankfurt, Naples, Vienna, Paris, and London. I have that right? And so they would set up these financial ties, and they became the creditors for the kings and princes, and that's why they were the Jews refer to Rothschilds as the King of Kings. obviously the Jews that's referred to Jesus Christ, but he became the kings of King of Kings because he became the creditors of these various potentates and princes and kings and governments, even and then later on presidents and prime ministers, and they control the financial lever of these governments and these countries, then you effectively control those societies. And that's when Rothschild apparently said, "I care not who writes the laws if you give me the power to print the money." I don't know if he actually said that. That's like
Yeah,
Voltaire's quote,
I've
right?
heard a citation. And by the way, I think the original guy was Meyer,
My
wasn't he?
yeah. But he basically established familial than tribal lines with the bankers, and we see that with the Rothschilds, and to this day now it's done through intermarriage, but also just through again through financial ties, because again, if you live in a post-Reformation Judeo-Masonic world which worships money, if you control the money, you can you that's the lever from which you can control the world. It's the fulcrum, and that's sort of
The quote is,
the
it describes a real and accurate thing. I mean, I've just never found a good citation to link it to, a Rothschild.
Yeah, it's one of those apocryphal things that's true. So it doesn't matter who said it, it's true.
It's just true. That's why I use the expression all the time, because not because I think it's I have a good citation, just because I think it's a good concept to put in play. People should be aware of it.
And so but then you have the merging of the British Empire with the Rothschild financial empire, and this occurs in the 19th century. One of the things the Rothschild controlled the Bank of London, that he was able to seize control of it effectively after the Battle of Waterloo, supposedly, when he publicly went short on the British pound, but privately went long on it and was able to stage a financial coup. This basically was achieved through his control of information, intelligence networks, and all that. So he could he more or less have information that he could act upon. That's an old network, is you have occulted information, and you come across looking like a genius, but you just have information.
Soros and Getty both
Do the
benefited
same thing, exactly. So it's
trading,
speculative.
and they become billionaires because they are Rothschild, insiders
And then
and
you can use your largesse to install people like, stooges like Fannie Willis to destroy the, host
exactly.
countries.
It's that is a apt and true, description.
Or NGOs that flood the country with illegal immigrants.
And that's right. Things like that. This is so you get to really be able to be a powerful person. And if your vision is genocidal, which it is obvious the case here, boy, the rest of the world is gonna suffer because, at the top, at the political top, we are dealing with individuals who are going to use the political power to, destroy our culture and then leave us defenseless for their, the return of the copybook headings, with gods who are going to slaughter and terror. That's what we have in our future.
And so again, something like the Rothschilds, again, they were able to merge with the British elite, the British aristocracy, who were cash poor and land rich because the land they had stolen during the Reformation. And so it was basically through the leverage of usury that the Jews were able to gain leverage over the British establishment, and more or less take over the British Empire. And under the cover, of the British Empire, the Rothschild Empire expanded, and then it merged with the United States in the early part of the 20th century, with the Pilgrim Society and the Union Now and all that. And we saw that, of course, that's manifested in the United States being pulled into two world wars in the first half of the 20th century on behalf of the British Rothschild, Judeo Empire to
Yeah,
bail
and
them out.
they're very clever in how they can camouflage it. I mean, because that's, I guess, the whole purpose of Freemasonry, right, is to stay secret. Look at India and look at British colonialization of India. It was completely done through the lodge system, and yet this is something that is never mentioned, that they set up lodges, Freemason lodges, which ran the politics of all of the regions in all of the zones of the Raj, right? And so it was a Masonically controlled continent. And when they left with their stooges in place that then they disappeared from the political, cover, but a political vision, but they were still there with their power. This also happened then in China. I mean, you have the lodge system acting with the Chinese secret societies, and then you end up with Mao. Well, Mao has all these direct connections into Yale. Just think of how many Chinese have like people from Skull and Bones in their inner circle, So it's off, and then of course Russia. You have the end of the Bolsheviks, which are obviously, a Masonic project. But then what is really left? I mean, do you really think that Putin is someone who isn't influenced by this group? I think that they are very meticulous in their kind of maintenance of the power. And they have been able to get in almost every political house in the world. But this isn't sort of a black pill kind of moment. I mean, this is just the task in front of us. It should be pretty easy to expose this, right? And I think that's really, we talk a lot about, well, where does this all go? What is the purpose of the independent media? You have the lifetime actors, people like Alex Jones and the medical freedom. You have like people who are attacking the government, like Malone, but you see that they're just taking us into these intellectual cul-de-sacs where we are not really continuing to develop an understanding of exactly who is behind all these bad things. And that's really what the independent media is doing. It's slowly mowing through all of the camouflage and the cul-de-sacs. It's getting out of the cul-de-sacs that the lifetime actors like Alex Jones, kind of put us in. And it's getting more and more focused on the Judeo-Masonic control of the political system, because that's really where the independent media is going to end up, is with putting an awareness of that fact into everybody so that we just know what our world is, and then we can respond to it.
Yeah, to properly understand this, again, a lot of blame or credit, if you will, depends how you look at it, for the New World Order or the modern world is the British Empire. But the British Empire represented a partnership between Jewish finance and the British aristocracy that I mentioned. This was acknowledged as early as 1922 in Hilaire Belloc's, he was a Catholic writer in England, his book, The Jews. This is he basically. He was right. He said that basically the New World Order is an extension of the British Empire, in which the elite British, American, and Jewish imperialist interests are indistinguishable. They merge. He wrote. Belloc wrote. Marriages began to take place wholesale between who had once been the aristocratic territorial families of this country and the Jewish commercial fortunes. After two generations of this, with the opening of the 20th century, those of the great territorial English families in which there was no Jewish blood was the exception. So there was a co-mingling, of course, the merging with the United States. This vast financial network was also able to flex its muscle in the United States, and that's illustrated in the Balfour Declaration, when the promises made to Rothschild to the British Empire to support the creation of the Zionist state in Palestine. In return, the Jews would use their leverage in the United States to get the country into the war, which was then not going well for Great Britain. And that's the Balfour Declaration. Something's not taught about the Balfour Declaration. And even in World War II, there was what's called the New World Order pledge to the Jews. This was in 1940, an article appeared in New York Times vowing that a post-war New World Order would be created. World Jewry would be the central to the building of the New World Order. This was promised by Arthur Greenwood. Arthur Greenwood was a Labour Party leader, member of the House of Commons. He played a crucial role in shifting government momentum towards war with Germany, and he was the primary advocate against accepting Hitler's various multiple peace offers to Great Britain in the summer of 1940 after his defeat of France. So there, he was instrumental in promoting the war, and he saw, I mean, prolonging the war. And he was appointed, I think, in 1940. Greenwood was appointed minister without portfolio in Churchill's war cabinet. His influence again proved decisive in Britain's war with Germany, after France had declared war on Germany and had been swiftly defeated by Germany in that summer. So again, and what they, of course, we see what the war does. Germany is defeated, and it becomes a pretext for the creation of NATO, U.S. occupation, effective occupation of Europe. But then again, the same way the British Empire had been merged with Jewish interests, the U.S. Empire gradually became merged with Jewish interests. Now Jewish interests. Now in the United States, there was still a very influential WASP elite. But I mentioned the WASP elite have been undermined or weakened, at least spiritually, intellectually. This goes back to their roots in the Reformation, meaning the WASP elite. The Reformation broad, this is my Catholic bias, but showing the Reformation was broadly speaking a Judaizing influence, meaning the worship of money and commerce. That's where the British Empire comes into play. So once you commerce and money become your effective religion, you become easily Judaized or influenced by Jewish power because they control the levers of finance. And so this was, and of course, in the second half of the 20th century, you have Jewish ascendancy. This was a quiet revolution that occurred in the United States. It was the waning of the WASP elite and the ascendancy of the Jewish elite in the 60s and 70s and 80s to now, when now the junior partners in this relationship in the Brit in the American Empire became the primary or the principal agents or principal partners of this relationship. And this is because of the control of the media. This is the seduction, the control, cultural Jewish dominance of the United States in the second half of the 20th century through culture, primarily entertainment, pop culture, these things. So now we come to the point where today, we see today, like the United States is now forced to underwrite and endorse genocide of the Palestinians. And no. So now we're U.S. government has bloodied the Americans or implicated the American government, therefore the Americans in this efforts in Palestine to eradicate, ethnically cleanse them. 2 million people have been uprooted and removed. 30,000, at least 30,000 have been killed by Israeli bombs. 70% of reportedly are women and children, so they're not Hamas. And so this is where it's relevant to today's issues.
And you know, I just wanted to mention that the lifetime actor concept is very important in analyzing this. You know, you know people like Lindsey Graham. You know, you wonder, well, how can someone be so idiotic? Well, he's not. He's actually simply playing a role. All the world is staged for these mm-hmm. people, and they're given parts, and so there's control of Lindsey Graham. If you look at, you talk about the Balfour Declaration, look at the process by which it came into existence, and you'll see that there weren't Jews or overt Jews in the process. You have Palmerston and the Churchill family and the Cecils and Salisbury. These are all WASPs in a sense, but they're all, I think, a better, more, you know, perfect way of understanding them is they're all Grandmaster Freemasons.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a Masonic project, which then has this stagecraft of interacting with overt Jews to create like what looks like a reasonable legal process. A good example of this is McMahon and Hussein, where McMahon is you know talking about what it'll be like after World War I if the Arabs fight on the side of the British. Well, McMahon is the head Freemason of the region. He knows perfectly well that following the war, they're going to put the Balfour Declaration out. I mean, he's part of that whole family and Masonic clump, but he pretends. He has an image, a lifetime acting role as this, you know, objective British general who's just there trying to, you know, do the best for everyone. Well, we need to be more clever, and we need to look past, you know, the words that these people give us to kind of determine, well, how did they come into existence? You know, I mean, I think a Lindsey Graham would be a good example of someone just can't be this stupid. Our Christie, you know, I mean, they are slavishly Zionist to the point of hysteria. Well, and yet they're purportedly, you know, Christian. Well, how can this be? It just seems inexplicable. When you try to deconstruct the New World Order, you need to remember that a lot of the people in political power, media power, who are purportedly Christian are not. They are part of the Judeo-Masonic project one way or another. They're either literally, you know, family members who are pretending, or they're under some kind of control because of sexual blackmail.
Well, they've been blackmailed, bribed, and indoctrinated. And that's the whole point of like the Cecil Rhodes Trust, the scholarship, is you create a whole white way of thinking, which rationalizes and justifies it. You're in this circular way of thinking. You're in this loop. You can't think outside the box, so to speak. That was the whole purpose of indoctrination. And
remember, Cecil Rhodes was purportedly a Gentile, but then his sister spilled the beans and pointed out he was a Jew.
Well, that and also the fact he worked for the Rothschild, De Beers, that was a Rothschild
Just an
too.
example,
You that, Rhodes gets the blame, if you will, and because he deserves it, you can say that. But he was acting on behalf; he was an agent on behalf, acting on behalf of somebody, and it wasn't the British people. It was the Rothschild financial interest, which then controlled the British state, the British Empire, at the time. And there's an account that that in the book, which is Nigel Ferguson, the popular economic historian, who good writer. But in his book on the Rothschilds, he talks about the time when the British were looking to buy the Suez Canal, and what happened? The British Prime Minister Disraeli, Parliament wasn't in session, and the bill couldn't be passed to purchase the stocks from the French concerns to take over the Suez Canal. So he borrowed the money from Rothschild. And Rothschild said to him, he said, "What do you offer in collateral?" So I offer you the British state. So that's it in a nutshell, if you will. So
You remember even that, of course, think about how,
by the way, they were buddies. So
well, yeah, of course, they were dining, companions. But the thing is, think about from Palmerston's declaration, 1840, that now is the time for the Jews to return to the Holy Land. All of these events, many of them are connected directly into the Rothschild family, start occurring one after another, which bear the stamp of the British political reality, but in fact are just part of this project. I mean, that they started to control the flow of goods through the Suez Canal. They built railroads. They had survey after survey, all funded by Masons or the British Crown, to analyze the Palestine to determine which parts they should steal first,
Well,
which.
yeah, the destruction of mineral wealth, I think, coincides with the Rothschild support for Zionism project, for the Zionist project.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Well, like
So,
South Africa.
coincidence? So
Which, of
that's
course,
when.
now there you have who's going on there? Winston Churchill's father, and working with Cecil Rhodes, and they're stealing all of the metals and minerals of the place. And
Owns like 60,000, who is indebted like 60,000 pounds to Natty Rothschild.
yeah, so it's just this one. It's a pretty, easy to detect and to deconstruct clump of Judeo-Masonic kind of power and malevolence, and it's centered, as far as we can tell, around the Rothschild family. They very often pop up, and the British Crown. I mean, they're not the only
And the
player.
Rothschild family is Talmudic.
Oh yeah.
They're a Talmudic family, so you apply that to finance, you're in trouble. Now, the reason why I mentioned Talmudry is because the misanthropy, or misanthropism that we associate with Freemasonry is the same with the Talmud, how they view other people, Gentiles. And I get this idea because I was reading about Cecil Rhodes, and in 1877, in his Confession of Faith, he wrote his vision, and he wrote, "I contend that we are the finest race in the world, and that the more of the world we inhabit, the better it is for the human race. Just fancy those parts that are at the present inhabited by the most despicable specimens of human beings. Why should we not form a secret society with but one object, the furtherance of the British Empire and bringing about the whole uncivilized world under British rule for the recovery of the United States, for the making of the Anglo-Saxon race but one empire? To forward such a scheme, what a splendid help a secret society would be, a society not openly acknowledged, but who would work in secret for such an object." Well, I mean, that's okay, that's his opinion, but that's very Talmudic. And this very talk about repair the world, this vision, we're better than everyone else, the right to rule over them, and look at all the peoples as savages. Well, you can see the Jewish revolutionary spirit inhabiting one of Cecil Rhodes here.
Yeah, of course.
It's very similar in in this outlook, and this goes back, why the WASP, elite Protestants would become Judaizers. Well, from the get-go, they were, because they were seeking to relinquish Christian power, or Catholic power, or then ultimately Christian power, and they become avaricious, greedy, and then you're easily subjected to the money power when that occurs. And that occurred in the 19th century when they went in heavily into debt the Jewish creditors. And of course, it was Jewish creditors who were able to gain the lever of power, or a level of power within the West, because the liberalized West in the wake of the French Revolution, when the historic or traditional impediments to Jewish influence in these Christian societies were removed, a century, two, 3 centuries removed from that, what do we have?
Right. Well, I mean, look what happened in Russia. The workers' paradise is promised, political power and agency are sacrificed, and then suddenly you realize, or you get the experience of, they're just lifetime actors. They have a Talmudic anti-Gentile perspective, and the slaughter begins. And of course, in France, I mean, the French Revolution leads directly to Napoleon's control. The guy who's always pictured with his hand in his shirt, and his family's Masonic. He takes the fruit of the French young men and just slaughters them, right? For what purpose? And then he's heroized by the media after the fact, even though his only, like, effect was just to depopulate. Now you have Zelensky. He's the Ukrainian Napoleon, courageous, brave, fighting, and I'm sure they'll lionize him after the fact. But what is he actually doing? He's just genociding.
The
These are
Ukraine,
just,
yeah, he's
they're
getting rid
just,
of Ukrainians. Yeah.
yeah, they're
Did
just clever ways to depopulate Europeans.
you
And they
see
do it
that?
all.
Did you see John Stewart's take on Tucker Carlson's Potemkin visit to Russia?
No, but I actually saw just a tiny bit of it. I mean, he a smart comedian. He tried to explain that Carlson's I question as to why can't we have nice things, because Carlson was pointing out how all of our cities are trashed and they're,
Yes.
just cesspools. And Stewart was criticizing Carlson on the grounds that, well, this is the price of freedom.
We have to celebrate the fact that our subways are trashed, urine stained, and unsafe,
Yeah.
because that's freedom.
Yeah, it's just the inverse. It's like literally just Brave New World vocabulary,
Then he accuses
where
Tucker Carlson of.
we'll
He accuses Tucker Carlson of kissing up to power, as if there's no other power outside Putin. Who is John Stewart kissing up to?
Well, remember, Stewart's brother is, I think he's actually on the New York Federal
He used to head
Reserve
the
Board.
stock exchange, I think, yeah.
Yeah, but I think he went on to I could be wrong. That's not a hard fact in my mind, but he was certainly head of the stock exchange. So I mean, like, who's kissing up to power?
I know.
It's ridiculous. So these are just ways to,
Well, Putin, he also went after Putin for giving his nuanced or, pretty accurate depiction of the outbreak of the Second World War and the intrigues of Poland and the Western powers. And of course, Tucker, I mean, sorry, excuse me, John Stewart is relying on the audience's complete ignorance of the complexities of the outbreak of that conflict,
Yeah, of course. Of course. And they just get away with these things. They can lie almost right to us because the public is too stupid and getting more stupid every day.
I mean,
I
I think
mean,
I'm kind of flattered that Putin is talking about Polish intransigence backing of, the blank check the British gave to Poland, Halifax's role in that. And Putin is kind of alluding to that. Can you think of any Western politician talking about that in the context of Second World War, other than this cartoonish heroic fairy tale we've been told?
What Western politician would even address his audience as an adult? I mean,
Yeah.
they don't even talk about these things. They're always just platitudes. And of course, the nuance of World War II is there. And if you don't know it, you can't make any sense of it. Putin, I thought, as I mentioned, Putin is really talking to his audience, the
Yeah.
Russians, to give them an understanding of why Russia needs to continue on with the operation, because I'm sure there's some resistance to the there must be some of kind of re reaction to all of the Russian totalities in this mess. And I, as we t discussed, incidentally, the 2 year anniversary is coming up, just one of the right now, I
Yeah,
believe.
2 years now, yeah.
And if you recall, 2 years ago we talked about it, and we said at that time, we said, this won't end. This is a Gentile depopulation agenda. It's just part of the overall. And so it's like World War One, World War Two. Since there is no real rationale for it, no legitimate rationale, there isn't any real process, right, by which the thing can come to an end. Both sides now, Russia and the West, are engaged in an internal struggle, right? There's no defined kind of we will end when we lose this many Ukrainians or when we take this much land. It's just not going to stop. The only way it can stop is through overwhelming public opinion, giving the oligarchs pause. That's the only way you can ever bring this to an end.
And one thing that's done, this is typical of a Jewish funny man, is his critique of Tucker Carlson inevitably descended into scatological and sexual innuendo and references. It was like to get cheap laughs. I'm like, come on,
He just can't help himself,
can't help himself. It's like there's the internal Mel Brooks. He can't help it.
I mean, he is really just a absolutely vicious sophist, you know. I mean, Stuart knows what he's doing, and he's not just stupid, you know. He knows what he's doing, and so he's engaging in propaganda. And
And by the way, when he's off script, he comes across as being really stupid. You know,
yeah, well.
but he told he thought it was a some sort of coup or some sort of takedown when he told Tucker Carlson years ago that he was what did he call him? An a-hole or a jerk or something. And then that's the
Something.
first
I mean,
I was like, that's it? You call him a name and
well,
that's a
this
takedown.
is where our political discourse is headed. I mean,
Yeah.
Biden called Putin, what was the expression?
I think did he call him a douchebag or something like
No, it was something like an insane son of a bitch or something. It's just, I forget, but it was just vulgar and stupid, you know. And the idea of like a president, you know, describing someone, you know, another head of
Well,
state.
we can't hold Biden responsible for what he says because he's not responsible. He can't even be held account in the courtroom for his misdeeds because he's not mentally competent. So.
Well, what he needs is to put Fannie Willis in as a spokesperson.
He almost does, doesn't
Well, he does. I mean,
he?
that's right, come to think of it. But yeah, so upcoming week, Tim, I'm predicting there'll be more salacious revelations, and I also think that Fannie Willis, I'm predicting right now, will she's going to attack the phone cell tracking system as racist.
Well, idea of evidence-based prosecutions are at or an attribute of white supremacy. So,
Right, well, evidence, but they're a thing of the past, I'm afraid.
okay, Joe, I'll let you go.
Thank you so much. We'll get them next week. Bye
Take
bye.
care. Bye bye.